KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks your business is really, really all right, life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, when you think of the Cannes Film Festival, you think big stars, red carpets, yachts, and mostly artsy movies. But behind the scenes, there's the Cannes Film Market, where hundreds of independent movies are looking for money in a tough economy. Plus, the broadcast networks had their big party last week, unveiling their fall schedules for advertisers at the television upfronts. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood, Hollywood, Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, I have been in New York for the upfronts, and that's where my brain has been marinating in the broadcast networks, and we'll have more on that later in the show. But, John, you've been keeping an eye on the other big event of this season, and that is Cannes. What's been going on?
Let's just say there's been a lot more business at the upfronts than there has been at the Cannes Film Festival. Going into the festival, everybody was a little nervous about whether people would spend money. And they certainly spent money throwing the big parties, the yacht parties, the Robin Hood premieres. But it's been an incredibly slow sales year. And I have to say, the critics have not been very excited about anything except maybe Carlos, which is... You're ready to take off a day from work is a 5.5 hour movie.
Let's go get some a bite and go see that.
you have buns of steel.
Yes, thank you, John, for noticing.
But that has been the big deal so far to the festival. I mean, I think it shows in some ways that the American specialized film distribution apparatus and what's happening at Cannes are two very different things. Carlos, this movie apparently is fantastic. Carlos the Jackal, a Venezuelan revolutionary. It's 5.5 hours long.
Yes, yeah.
But in a kind of typical release platform, it will appear as a miniseries on the Sundance Channel and then come out theatrically in a couple of territories in the
States. Conclude that this is not a gigantic commercial enterprise.
No, and I have to say there's probably not one of those movies yet. Sony Classics bought the Mike Lee movie another year.
That supposed to be well received?
It got pretty good reviews, respectful. Mm-hmm. And then there's Alejandro González Iñárritu, who made Babel, and Amores Perros. He had a new movie called Beautiful, but almost a week after the film had its first screening, there still was no buyer for it in North America.
I saw some pretty mixed reviews on that, too.
Yeah, so I would have to say you chose wisely. The upfronts appear to have been much more newsworthy than Cannes this year.
So the Cannes Film Festival is obviously known for arty films, but also, you know, the studios do like to show up and splash some movies out there, some regular old commercial studio films. One of them was Wall Street 2, starring the young Shia LaBeouf. And he had some interesting words to say in public about his movie that Steven Spielberg made, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Well, it's you know, something you never hear in Hollywood is honesty. And I guess the problem for Shia is that he actually spoke candidly about the film being disappointing. And
well, and
I can't
he specifically
say anybody...
said, you know, you can blame it on the writer and you can blame it on Steven. I'll probably get a call, but he needs to hear this. I mean, maybe he doesn't want to hear it, particularly at a press conference in Cannes.
Where you're trashing Steven Spielberg, who, of course, we should note, is also producing Transformers, which is a minor little movie that Shia has been in as well.
And we have seen his co-star, Megan Fox, abruptly disappear from Transformers after she said that working with the director, Michael Bay, was like... that he was like Hitler, I believe, was the quote. So, I don't know. Are there consequences to this behavior, John?
Apparently, although I can't imagine that the next Transformers movie will be made without Shia. But I guess that's the price to pay. You know, if you are kind of on the cusp and you say something indelicate, you're tossed. But if you're a big star like Shia, maybe you get reprimanded, but you don't lose your job.
Yeah, they need somebody. Although in the waning era of star power, you should really watch yourself. You know, there are very few stars that really have clout these days.
Oh, there's one star. You know this, Kim. The one star is 3D.
3D. And boy, if you went to see Shrek Forever After over the weekend, or if you intend to, you have a pain in your wallet.
This is a, I mean, there are thresholds that you cross as in the movie business, the first $100 million movie, the first $200 million. This Shrek Forever After, apparently the first $20 movie ticket. There's an analyst in New York named Richard Greenfield, and he did a study, and he went to, like, he actually left his office and went to a theater.
Good for him.
The AMC Kips Bay, where an IMAX 3D movie ticket for Shrek Forever After was more than $20. And he said the same 3D ticket was $16.50 in March. That is inflation like on an Argentinian scale.
You know, I find it sort of interesting that, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg has been sounding the alarm about bad-looking 3D, but what about the alarm about these prices? What are really going to be? I think we've talked about this before. Who can deal with those?
Well, and the movie business has had a long and, I would argue, successful tradition of arguing that going out to movies is actually a relatively inexpensive night out, especially compared to theme parks or professional sports. And listen, if the ticket pricing keeps going this high, it's going to be a real problem. I think Shrek Forever After is still going to work. I think it's a satisfying movie. But the summer is being filled with a couple other movies, and we have not seen the first 3D fiasco, and I think it could be coming soon.
That is all the banter we have time for. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. The 63rd annual Cannes Film Festival wrapped this past weekend after 10 days of black tie premieres, high fashion, paparazzi, and mostly highbrow movies. But while all that was going on, business was being done at the Cannes Film Market, or Marché du Film. The market is 51 years old, and it runs concurrently with the festival every year. Not every film gets to be in the Cannes Film Festival, but any producer can put a movie into the market. Some 600 films were looking for buyers this year, some finished, some not finished, some just ideas with some talent attached. The hope was to score sales deals with international buyers who were looking for movies for their home audiences. Before the recession, there was a lot of money in the marketplace, leading to a glut of movies and a glut of burned investors. Now, needless to say, these are tough times in the independent film world. To get a sense of the scene at the Cannes Film Market this year, producer Darby Maloney talked to Jonathan Wolf, Executive Vice President of the Independent Film and Television Alliance and Managing Director of the American Film Market.
How would you characterize the mood and the atmosphere at the film market this year?
Surprisingly upbeat. We were curious coming in, I think many people would be, as to how the marketplace was. And in talking to maybe 100 companies over the last week, the general tone has been cautiously optimistic, little better than I expected. These are the phrases that they would use. And part of the reason was there was a dramatic cut in production. You know, the consumer's demand for film hasn't changed. Through all the machinations of the economy in the last 3 years, consumers are still seeing film. In fact, they're seeing more. What's changed is the dramatic decrease in production has yielded firmer prices. And this is what the sales companies here and the producers here were looking for. And they started to say, well, the pendulum hasn't moved all the way. It's getting closer to being a seller's market than a buyer's market. And this is what they've been waiting for.
Okay, so what kind of films are selling this year?
The films at the market can really be broken into a couple groups. And that is those films that are what's called pre-sold. In the independent film business, a lot of films are sold before they're made. So maybe half of the distributors and producers who are coming here are not coming here with finished films. They're coming here with projects that they're looking for the foreign buyers to buy before they're made. And the other half are coming with finished films. Those that have projects tend to stay more into genres that translate easily. Horror, erotic thrillers, action adventures, comedies that are based on the visual, not on the words. Because those are easy to understand and easy to convey to the buyer and are less sensitive to a successful execution by the director.
And not tied to a particular language.
Correct.
Okay.
Films that are tougher to sell in the pre-sale are really adult dramas, comedies that are very talky, films that have a difficult subject matter, or maybe really dependent on a tremendously successful execution by the director. And those films then really need the equity to come in to have the film made first, and then the film is screened and hopefully accepted. So can you see both of those business models going forward?
Now, when people make a pre-sale deal, what are they basing that on? Are they seeing an extended trailer, reading a script? What do they have to go on to trust?
The most common is they are reading a script, they are presented at least with a summary budget, and they're presented with the primary cast and usually the director. The contract will specify it will not divert significantly from the script that's attached to the contract. It will have at least the certain actors that were named, and or it'll have the director, and or there'll be a minimum budget. The buyers are very, very bright, and they're very sophisticated. They just don't sort of say, oh, that's a good idea. Here, I'll commit to $1 million. Call me when it's done. They're signing binding agreements, and they've been doing this for decades, and they know exactly what to put in that agreement to make sure that they're going to get at least what was promised. Now, what was promised isn't always a good film, but it will have all the elements that they've committed to. And this is why, as I said earlier, when they tend to stay in specific genres, it's more likely that the film will result in something that everyone anticipated it would be, whether it's action, adventure, horror, erotic, thriller, or some other specific genre. When they get into very talky, you know, dramas, that's when you get into a risky area.
So what percentage, I know you haven't seen any of the films in the market, but what percentage are those kind of known quantity genre pictures?
Boy, I would have to say probably half at least. And it's not because the industry says that's necessarily what the public wants, but some film companies are risk adverse. They're only going to make films that they can pre-sell. And those who have more equity take risk, and since there are always fewer and fewer risk takers these days, you tend to see more of that type of film. But the big trend we're seeing is an increase in indigenous production around the world, from Asia, from Europe, and a decrease in production we're starting to see now from the U.S. And throughout the rest of the world, they're not as dependent as the U.S. is on pre-sales. This is because in most countries of the world, the film industry is considered a cultural asset, and it is supported by the government. It is supported through cultural money, is supported through business incentives. If you make a film in Korea or Hong Kong, you are guaranteed a theatrical release. You are guaranteed to be on their version of network television. If you make an independent film in the United States, you're guaranteed nothing. And so many of these films, given a different cost model and given guaranteed revenue, can see sometimes 80 to 100% of their budget come back in-country. This is especially true in India and China, and usually close to being true in South Korea, very true in Japan. And so when these countries come to the export market, they're coming with prices that are dramatically undercutting U.S. sellers, only because the producer in those countries doesn't need very much money. They've come out even in their own country.
So do you have a sense of who's there with deep pockets and who's buying?
Well, when you have a sense of that, it's always talked about from a standpoint of countries, not companies, meaning that 10 years ago, Japan as a country represented the largest buyer outside of the U.S., and frequently independents could look for 10 to 12% of their budget to come outside of Japan. Now Japan is ranked sixth among the countries outside the U.S., with Germany and the U.K. first. And it's not because Germany and the U.K. increased, it's because Japan decreased.
Yeah, I was reading that Russia seems to be buying more product than they had in the past.
Russia is growing. All of the former Soviet bloc are growing because their per capita GDP is going up. And to look at trends of where there's going to be growth, we tend to look at per capita GDP and see where the trend lines are. That will ultimately indicate where there's going to be increases for the film industry. Russia, which wasn't on the top 10 list 10 years ago, I think is ranked 7th or 8th in terms of its value to independence.
How influential would you say the Cannes film market is on what we in the United States actually see in our theaters and on DVD and TV over the next year, year and a half?
The Cannes film market and the American film market have a tremendous influence on what we see. Not so much on what American buyers buy for the American consumer, so much as what international buyers agree to pre-buy, therefore the American producer can go make the film. There are many films that Americans fall in love with that would have never been made had the buyer from Germany and Japan and Italy and France not committed to the film in advance, because the American producer wouldn't have had the money. They needed the commitments from the buyers around the world to make the film. You know, more than half the Academy Awards for Best Picture the last 30 years have been independent films. The majority of them have been pre-sold at Cannes or at the American film market, from the Lord of the Rings trilogy to Crash to Slumdog Millionaire and Hurt Locker, all pre-sold at the AFM and Cannes, all would not have come forward without the commitments of these distributors around the world.
Well, Jonathan Wolff, thank you so much.
And at midnight in Cannes, it's great to talk to you.
Jonathan Wolff is Executive Vice President of the Independent Film and Television Alliance. He is Managing Director of the American Film Market. He joined us by phone from the Cannes Film Festival and Market in France.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television.
While the film world was focused on Cannes, the television community had its eyes glued on New York. That's where the networks were holding the television upfronts, the annual gathering where they roll out their new shows in hopes of selling about $9 billion worth of commercial time. Each network took its turn, pitching its schedules, showing clips of new shows, and trotting out stars, usually followed by lavish parties. We're talking sushi and pasta and barbecue, and I really hope the leftovers, which must have been abundant, ended up someplace worthy. After a dismal experience in 2009, the tone this year was more one of cautious optimism. The networks made it clear that they're going to spend in pursuit of hit shows, and they stressed that despite the internet, despite cable, broadcast television still has the biggest audiences and therefore are most worthy of advertising dollars. That was their argument. I was at the upfronts on assignment for The Hollywood Reporter, and I'm joined now by my temporary colleague, James Hibbard, who writes the Reporter's live feed blog. James, you made quite a splash at the upfronts this year. I want to paint a picture for the listeners. You know, ABC presents its fall schedule at Lincoln Center, and you have to imagine packed rooms. And Jimmy Kimmel does a little shtick at the beginning. He's always very funny. And he sort of started out this year saying that NBC likes to keep its programming a secret for as long as possible, sometimes forever. Unfortunately, a writer from The Hollywood Reporter, James Hibbard, snuck into their upfront rehearsal and released the whole NBC schedule the day before it was announced, which upset them, Jimmy Kimmel said, because when you have bad news, you want to deliver it yourself. It's the right thing to do. What happened? You were banned from the NBC presentation because of your bad behavior, right? So tell us how this came to be.
Well, I was staying at the same hotel as NBC was having its upfront, and that in itself is unusual because normally upfronts aren't at hotels. They're normally at theaters like Carnegie Hall.
Right. And I should just say that this is yet another symptom of the bad things that NBC had done in the past. They said they weren't going to have an upfront. That's so boring. And that lasted about a year or two. And they were back doing the upfront, but they can't get their old venue, which was Radio City Music Hall. Now they're at the Hilton. But you were at the Hilton, too.
And I decided to check out their setup because they're set up in the ballroom there. And the ballroom doors were open, and I walked in, and they were setting up for a rehearsal. And they put up the schedule, and they went through it, and they went through all the scripts with the tech crew reading for Jeff Gaspin and Angela Bromstead.
That's the respective top executives at NBC, I should say.
Yes, and then just walked out with a story.
Coming up after a short break, more lowdown on the TV upfronts. What new show do you want to check out? Tell us on the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The television upfronts are the annual ritual in which the networks unveil their new programming for the fall. The networks hope to make a good impression on advertisers and sell about $9 billion worth of commercial time. Last year, the market was way off due to the recession, but the mood this year was better. Advertisers saw clips from a lot of new shows, and while they didn't love all of them, it was clear that their wallets are going to open a little wider for these new programs. I'm talking about the upfronts with James Hibbard, who writes the live feed blog for The Hollywood Reporter. They have a lot of work to do at NBC. They have a ton of new shows. Their dilemma, of course, as you know, is that they don't have a ton of hits with which to launch these new shows. And that's what the problem is when you start circling the drain as a network. You need hits to launch more hits.
At the end of the day, what they're doing is correct structurally. They're going for big-name producers.
Jerry Bruckheimer and J.J. Abrams, people like
that. Exactly. But there's a limited number of people that are really good at doing those jobs, and they're looking for those people. The alternative is to sort of take chances with lesser knowns, and they are banking and spending the money to get the higher, bigger name producers. The only question is will the shows end up being good?
Let's talk about Fox.
They're the top-rated network, so they love numbers. They give you all sorts of numbers several different ways. And then they calf their upfront with the cast of Glee coming out and singing Madonna's Like a Prayer. So it's almost like this left brain, right brain double punch thing that they do.
Yes. And they're really pushing Lone Star, which they're saying it's sort of like updated Dallas, right? A guy with two lives, a wife and a girlfriend. They also have a couple of comedies. Running Wild from the creator of Arrested Development, which looked really weird.
It looked like the trailer for like a bad comedy movie more than a regular series.
Yeah.
Almost.
The story that the Fox executives were handing around was that you have to see the whole thing. I would say we both share the impression that probably you do. Right?
Well, I mean, you know, to some extent, you know, that's a lot like Arrested Development, which Mitch Hurwitz and Will Arnett were also involved in that it wasn't the most clip-friendly show because the punchlines were all earned over the course of the show, you know, as opposed to that more Two and a Half Men
set up joke, right.
Exactly.
Yeah, the one that worked better was Raising Hope, which is this one about this sort of slacker who decides he's going to raise this baby. And that certainly clipped well, at least. You know, it's always misleading at the upfronts. You can't really trust the clips. You can't really trust that the rest of the shows are going to look like the pilot. But that one seemed pretty funny to me. Yes?
I was surprised, too. Yeah. I mean, because that's not really my sort of type of show. And when I realized the concept, I'm like, oh, boy. And yet it had a little bit of humor and sweetness to it that I think people liked.
Fox has one more gigantic bet, which is not even scheduled right now. Steven Spielberg produced a very expensive time travel, prehistoric Jurassic Park during the Jurassic era or something like that. Terra Nova. Wow, it really sounds tremendously risky, doesn't it?
It's a really big swing. Executives told me that they're looking at it costing about $4 million per episode.
Yowza.
The idea of doing an action, adventure, family drama that takes place 150 million years ago, I mean, it's a very ambitious idea, you know, and it could be, potentially, and this is what they hope it'll be like one of those huge events that raises the bar for what a television pilot can be, like Lost did.
Now, ABC, as you pointed out at one point during our travels in New York, ABC has benefited from the miseries of NBC. People are distracted by really big holes in their schedule, and they're losing a bunch of shows. Obviously, the number one that they're losing would be Lost.
Well, you wouldn't know it from watching the upfront, though, because their upfront was all about Lost.
I mean, it was weird,
clips,
yeah.
They had a retrospective. They had Matthew Fox out on stage.
Remember Lost, everybody. We're the network that brought you Lost.
Like, you know, the upfront's about setting up product that you're going to be selling in the fall. So it was a little bit weird how much time they spent on a show that's ending.
And, you know, if you look at what's still there, they're fading shows. Desperate Housewives, Brothers and Sisters, Private Practice. So even with the ones they have left, they are facing problems. They had a very Spartan presentation, unlike Fox. They really had they brought out a few stars from Modern Family, whatnot, but no party, no press call in advance that is normally at least a press call, if not a breakfast. They just came out, they
talked about their new shows. They have Detroit 187, which is Michael Imperioli, whom we remember from The Sopranos or Life on Mars. They have another one, No Ordinary Family, which is sort of like live action The Incredibles, the family with superpowers.
I think it has a strong concept and a strong cast. It's just a matter of whether the writers could pull it off. I think it has potential.
Now, Better Together, they had a sitcom I thought clipped great. It's hard to explain the setup. It's a sort of a couple that's been together a long time without getting married, and then there starts to be a question of whether they ought to get married, and I just thought it clipped tremendous.
People seem to really like it, and it has like three different couples of three different generations in it. They're all part of the same extended family, so it has a little bit of similarity with Modern Family. And I'm, in fact, surprised they're not giving it a Modern Family lead-in.
They're putting it before Modern Family, which makes you wonder a little bit.
You know, ABC's whole scheduling strategy was a little bit odd this year. They used new shows to fill holes, which is what networks usually do in mid-season, rather than use their current hits to launch new shows. And so overall, that gave me the impression that maybe they're not quite as confident in their new material.
CBS, they were like the Dr. Kevorkian of the networks this time. They were just killing off existing shows left, right, and center, like seven shows they killed.
To me, it wasn't the problem that they killed off seven shows. The problem was they did it right at the last minute. So it was all seven at once. And there had been an expectation, not in a small part because of things, you know, CBS said, you know, that at least a couple of them were going to continue.
And we're talking about things like The New Adventures of Old Christine with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and, Ghost Whisperer, which has been on forever.
That's a power move. I mean, when you cancel shows that are still doing at least okay in this economy, that indicates that they have confidence in their new shows.
Among them, I think probably the first primetime show based on Twittering and tweeting. And it's not actually called Bleep, My Dad Says. They use an expletive in the title. And it's some guy whose dad says weird stuff and he started putting tweets out about it.
He got a network deal after like 70 tweets. I think that has to be the least amount of copy ever written, you know, for an unknown writer to get a show on the primetime schedule.
And this one is going to star William Shatner. It's coming behind The Big Bang Theory, which is moved to Thursday night. Another bold stroke by CBS.
It's a really big move. It was very surprising. Moving Big Bang Theory to Thursdays opposite NBC's Community, it's a bit like Fox sending American Idol over to Fridays to nuke Wife Swap. You know, it's like this completely unfair, you know, annihilation. But Thursdays is the most lucrative night in terms of advertising of the week.
That's because, of course, people are sitting around saying, what movie should we see this weekend? And all the movie pour money into the advertising. Yeah.
And they're also shifting CSI New York to Fridays.
They've got a comedy, Mike and Molly, about a couple that meets in Overeaters Anonymous. This is the Monday night lineup. You know, they have 2.5 Men at 9, this new Mike and Molly, and then Hawaii 5-0. And I missed the clips from that one, James. How did they play?
It played great in the room. I mean, it looked better than I expected. It was more action-driven than I expected. I expected like CSI in Miami with a luau. You know, this was had really good energy. You know, I think the audience is definitely going to show up for that premiere.
James Hibbard writes the live feed blog for The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you for coming in, James.
Thank you.
To see the big broadcast network's new fall schedules, go to our website at kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is the executive producer of the show. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or thoughts about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button from our media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.